Here I am. All right. So Richard appears to be saying that there is a new physics and energy, which he says has been detected and measured, which we're going to talk definitely about in a moment, which is affecting the bees. Now, why this energy is suddenly present and why this year it's beginning to affect bees that have been basically doing the same dance for a couple of hundred years, we're going to find out. Stay right there. All right, Richard, I can measure energy. I can measure audio energy. I can measure it down so far that I can hear the grumblings of the earth, if I so desire. I can measure radio frequency energy above that, right on up into the microwave range, and then above that, of course, into light. Now, where does the energy that you're talking about fit in?
Well, it's measurable energy like any other energy, and the way that Kozarev and the other Russian scientists who've been working with us, as I said, for at least 50 years, if not longer, have been measuring it, is in physical effects, primarily with what are called torsion pendulums, which is one of the reasons why it's called torsion field physics. What happens is, what Kozarev discovered in the 30s and 40s was that if you have a rotating system or a vibrating system, mm-hmm. like a gyroscope in a laboratory, and it's rotating, spinning on its axis very fast, mm-hmm. and then you shake it at another angle, like, for instance, remember those little childhood gyros we used to get where you'd spin them up with a string?
Sure.
And they would sit on your finger and tilt at a strange angle, and they appeared to defy gravity?
Yes.
Well, he found that if he took one of those and produced two simultaneous motions, one was the spin of the gyro, and the other was to vibrate it, mm-hmm. to make it move through space at some other angle back and forth. And he had a torsion pendulum, which is a very finely balanced rod sitting on a very, very precise knife edge so that it will swing at the slightest movement of force. Like if you were to blow on it, it would really whirl around.
Right, I've got it. Okay.
And he would put this in a vacuum bell several meters away, even behind walls, that when he vibrated the spinning gyro, the torsion pendulum would rotate around almost like a locator beacon, one of those old-fashioned radio locator beacons where the antenna would focus on the source of radio waves.
Right.
And it would unerringly point to where the gyro was vibrating.
Hmm.
And he realized that there was a physics, theoretical physics, underlying this that went all the way back to 1913 to a guy named Dr. Elie Cartan, who came out after Einstein's relativity and produced an additional set of theories that were trying to, refine relativity in terms of the properties of space-time. And it became known as the Einstein-Cartan theory, and it predicted that there would be these waves that would be radiated by spinning systems, mm-hmm. as part of deformed space-time predicted by Einstein's theory.
So are you suggesting that the spinning Earth is beginning to jiggle?
It's everything is spinning. They're all jiggling, and it's the interaction of all the rotating masses that are changing their frequency that are detectable by torsion of detectors that are basically also spinning systems. You have to have a system which is capable of rotation in order to detect this, and it shows up as mechanical changes. And there are 10,000 papers that have been written in the last 50 years by about 100 physicists, 100 guys, half of them in the Soviet Union, hidden by the KGB, deliberately kept secret until the wall fell down, and then we got all this stuff flooding out from the old Soviet files, that are incredible laboratory examples of physicists in all different walks of background in life doing experiments. They've now built torsion field generators that actually can produce signals on demand. David built a very crude torsion detector out of a monofilament and a burn match. And the reason the match is important is because what is the most likely component of a burn match? It's carbon. And what is the molecular structure of carbon? it's tetrahedral. It all goes back to this fundamental hyperdimensional geometry. Now, I cannot, even in 3 hours, minus the questions, on the radio, do adequate justice to this incredible body of work that I discovered that is so complementary to what I've been saying for years and years and years. But fortunately, that's where we have the web. So what we're going to do in the next few days is to start publishing part one, part two, part three of this unified physics with the references to the actual papers and experiments that people out there who are, you know, kind of garage tinkerers can actually do. You can do this at home. It's perfectly safe. And you will discover amazing things. Now, bottom line, it turns out that the antenna on the bees are torsion field antenna. That's okay. Why, if you look at bees, look at and any insects, by the way, use the same technology, except they don't build geometric honeycombs and houses, so they're not their living environment is not as radically affected by whatever the change is in this background radiation field, this torsion field that has gone on and is going to continue to go on and get different, because I believe it's a frequency change. Here's why I think it's a frequency change.
Well, I was about to ask you, even with the method you described of being able to detect this force, that doesn't mean that you've actually measured it and understand how it's operating. It means you've detected it. You can see it there. But how are they able to measure the change in frequency and attribute it to the problem with the bees?
Well, they are not working. The torsion field guys are probably not even aware that there is a relationship between the torsion field physics and the bee problem.
Okay.
That requires generalists like me and David and others. All right. When we publish this, because the web goes all over, and we're going to make some calls to some of the key leading torsion field guys like Chipov, who was one of the leading lights now in the Soviet Union and in Russia. We're going to get them looking, and there's a whole separate study of honeycombs and how they are interacting with the torsion physics that was done by, as far as I know, only one guy. He's now dead. He was elderly. He was an iconoclast. He was your typical lone genius. You know, he pioneered the idea that bees and honeycombs were doing something that could be detected by detectors. But when he died, nobody picked up on his work. We have it on the web. It'll be part of the references in this series of references in the papers, and people can, you know, come to their own conclusion. The key thing here is it makes predictions. And one of the predictions is, going back to why we got two separate bee tracks a couple hundred years ago between the commercial producers and the organic producers. Mm-hmm. The commercial producers, for economic reasons, tried to make bigger bees by making bigger honeycomb.
Right.
The organic guys, you know, with the God is beautiful, nature knows everything, they've stuck like a religion with the natural bee order. Mm-hmm. Even though they tried to systematize it, and it turns out that's also not a good idea. What people in industry try to do is they try to follow Henry Ford and make things uniform, and it turns out the bees don't like uniform. Bees, in fact, build alternating size honeycomb in a natural environment that has the shape, get this, Art, of a tetrahedron.
Right.
And there will be images on our articles showing these natural, beautiful honeycombs where you have large honeycomb at the top, something like 5.9 millimeters across for each of the six-sided hexagonal cells. And at the very bottom in the core, where the egg laying goes on at certain parts of the year, and we'll get to that in a minute, it all goes all the way down to about 4.6 millimeters. Now, the average person might say, wait a minute, what's the difference between a 5.9 millimeter and a 4.6 millimeter honeycomb? Why should a bee care about that little change, that little size change? It cares if the honeycomb is like a tuned resonant receiver, Art. And you, of all people, should understand what tuned receivers do. And it doesn't take much of a change in an antenna to throw you off frequency.
That's right. I'm willing to concede the torsion physics possibility. I'm willing to concede the measurement you talked about. What I don't think that you've proven is that there's been a frequency change, and that specifically that has affected the bees.
Okay. Well, if one looks at this strictly in terms of the waves, if you have little guys living in a honeycomb of a certain size, and the background field changes so that that frequency no longer is resonantly in step with
then maybe they can't find their way home.
They can't. It doesn't resonate and create a signal.
I've got that. But
there's
what we haven't done is we haven't proven there's been a change in the frequency, or if we have, you haven't laid that out for us yet.
Okay, well, one of the things that I've been doing since you and I have been apart and not talking to each other on the radio is I have carried out a series of experiments at Coral Castle, one of your favorite places.
Mm-hmm.
And it started when I had the heart attack, and Robin took me down there as part of my therapy, and I wandered around, and then she noticed on the wall one of the things that Ed Lee Scanlon had left, which was basically a hexagon with two inscribed tetrahedra in it over his outdoor bathtub, which was kind of like a clear signal, this is the physics I'm using to build this place. So I've gotten very interested in Coral Castle. I took some ideas from my departed friend, Bruce De Palma, having to do with the Accutron watch. Remember the old Accutron watch?
Yes.
It had the little tuning fork?
Mm-hmm.
And I married up the Accutron with a computer program that lets me actually count the cycle, the frequency of the tuning fork, which is like a torsion pendulum. It vibrates back and forth. And remember, a vibration is a partial rotation. So my idea was, could the tuning fork in the Accutron be used as a detector of this torsion radiation?
Perhaps so.
And, well, the bottom line is absolutely 100% it is so. Because when I took it into Coral Castle, I've done it three times now we've done it more than three times because I was able to wire the castle and get months and months and months and months of long-term data during all different seasons and various celestial events. And you know, I've talked about alignments. It turns out the celestial alignments between spinning planets arcs creates wonderful tremors in the force, changes in the torsion field. And bottom line, I was able to replicably measure those changes. And those graphs, you know, will be part of our paper series that we're doing on this. I was able to, for instance, when Venus crossed the sun, the once every 120-year transit of Venus, where we have two of them 8 years apart. The next one is coming up in 2012. The first one was back in 2004. We got stunning results in the tuning fork sitting in the middle of Ed Lee Scanlon's 1,100 tons of coral. Now, why is coral, i.e. limestone, important? Because it's like a huge, huge beehive art. The coral is deposited in hexagonal little crystals by the little organisms that make the oolitic limestone. And when you cut it up and stack it like Lee Scanlon did, you basically create yourself a huge torsion amplifier. And putting my little Accutron in there with the computer attached, I was able to magnify the torsion signal. And when Venus crossed the sun, we got stunning results showing that a spinning planet 25 million miles away, where you could cover it with your fingernail, even smaller than your fingernail, had a measurable effect on a tiny, you know, few gram mass vibrating pendulum in this little watch hooked up to a computer. I did it during a total eclipse of the sun that was visible as a partial eclipse in Florida. Got the same effect, which replicated what Maurice Allais had inadvertently done with a torsion pendulum in Paris in 1954. And then I decided, was it possible that you could get rid of the castle? If the physics was changing the way I've been predicting, the waves are getting higher and higher, the amplitude of this is getting stronger as well as the frequency shifts, you should be able to do it without the castle. So I did it here during the transit of Mercury, and I had Robin literally looking at the computer screen as Mercury moved onto the surface of the sun, blocking it from its close orbit.
Right.
And bingo, exactly when first contact occurred, when the edge of spinning Mercury, which is rotating every 59 days, reached the edge of the sun, which is rotating backwards relative to Mercury at the equator, 27 days, there was this stunning frequency increase, not by a lot, by a few hundredths of a percent, but the accuracy of the tuning fork combination of the Accutron and the computer is down to 1 or 2 parts per million, so it's way above signal to noise. And Kozarev said in his own calculations that these effects are on the order of 10 to the minus 4 to 10 to the minus 5th, meaning 1/10,000th to 1/100,000th of the normal background entropic, electromagnetic, gravitational, other forces that objects feel. But if you have a tuned system, meaning two resonant rotating systems, you can increase that signal so that you can detect them easily. And with computer technology now, they're easily measurable. What I haven't done yet, and what I'm trying to figure out a way to do, is to use the tuning fork and measure the beehives. Because my prediction is that the beehives that are happy and fine will have one set of frequencies that I can measure. And the beehives that are subject to this sudden, you know, colony collapse disorder, mm-hmm. where the bees leave because they can't stand their environment anymore. Does that sound kind of familiar to people in L.A. or New York? That those will have a different frequency, and it should be measurable with the same torsion-type detectors that Kozarev pioneered over 50 years ago.
And all of this, you think, is occurring simply because of the...
The change in the background frequency.
Which is made apparent by the change in the construction of the hive.
That's right. Now, it turned out that what, according to, there's a beekeeper whose name I'm not going to talk about on the air tonight because there's some very curious things going on around his activities. He lived in Wyoming. He's got an extraordinary site. We'll be linking the site in the papers. He had done like 15 years of research, 1,500 experiments with natural beekeeping versus commercial beekeeping, standard foundation. And what he discovered was that even the organic beekeepers have gotten bad habits from their commercial friends, in that although they're producing smaller honeycomb and smaller bees, which turn out to be incredibly resistant to the mite problem, what he found was that any bee can be made to reproduce in any size honeycomb without change except in behavior. In the small honeycomb, the bees will clean the hive and eliminate the mites themselves. You don't have to fumigate. You don't have to put pesticides and fungicides and, you know, things that will attack the parasites. The bees do it themselves. You take those same bees and put them in the large honeycomb, they suddenly forget what to do. There's something in the torsion field which is basically reinforcing their behavior to be good housekeepers.
Okay, again, how long have we been using these larger hive constructions?
Hundreds of years. In fact, so, you know who the first guy was who was an astronomer who looked seriously into the size of honeycombs in terms of frequencies? Johann Kepler.
I wouldn't have guessed that.
Impossible to guess. Kepler, in addition to figuring out the orbit of Mars and elliptical planetary orbits, the huge breakthrough in physics that led to Newton and the theory of gravity, Kepler, remember, had another theory that no one ever took seriously, which he called the music of the spheres, the idea that rotating planets orbiting the sun had a natural etheric music that geometrically could be fit into their orbital parameters. And I think he got this idea. I can't say absolutely tonight, but I think based on some of the papers I've seen now that he got this idea because he absolutely kept bees. And he wrote about bees and beehives and bee behavior, which was stunning to me. It has to do with being a multidisciplinary generalist, putting dots together of things you wouldn't think would connect. Bottom line, I think the physics is changing. The frequency, the background torsion field is changing on Earth. Well, due to both the alignment of the planet with the galactic center, the whole 2012 thing, and due to the fact that Pluto, which is this little guy in this very inclined orbit, 17 degrees, has moved between us and the galactic center right now. And remember, I predicted based on this physics that there are two unseen big planets out there somewhere. And it's all about the alignment and geometry. I've now proven with the Carl Castle work that when you line up a planet with the sun, you get changes in the torsion field.
All right, hold it right there, Richard. Hold it. We'll be right back. Morning, everybody. Tomorrow night, Richard C.J. Somerville, who is a distinguished professor at Scripps Institution of Oceanography and a climate scientist, is going to be my guest. Very distinguished indeed, one of the top scientists in the area on what's going on with our atmosphere, with global warming and such, is going to discuss the effect of carbon dioxide, that which mankind is pouring into the atmosphere at a pretty great rate. Now, most of mainstream science right now is convinced, almost to the point of settled science, that this gas that we're putting into the atmosphere is indeed warming our planet. We just had a forecast by NASA that by, 2080, we'll be in the 100 to 110 degree mark in cities like Chicago, Washington, and Atlanta. I don't think too many disagree that the warming now is going on for years and years they did. Now, they're pretty much agreed. I think even Richard would agree the warming is going on. I don't think that he attributes it, though, to that gas. He thinks the warming is going on all the planets, and that probably weaves right back into what we were talking about with respect to the bees. That in a moment. Well, okay, a couple of quick things, Richard. First of all, am I right? Would you say that rather than the gases that we're putting into the atmosphere, you feel that not just Earth, but all the planets are warming, and you don't feel it's due to the gases that we're emitting, but rather some sort of uniform change in frequency, if you will, that relates right back to this?
Well, it's both. You know, I mean, there's a natural cycle that's going on all over the solar system that we can look at all the data. I mean, there's over 100 papers that we referenced in that first series we did back in 2004.
Yes.
NASA studies of warming and energy changes and phenomenology changes on planets all over the solar system. The most stunning one, of course, is Pluto. Pluto, as you know, is about 4 billion miles from the sun. It's no longer a planet. Sorry about that. It's leaving the sun. It is in an elliptical orbit, and ever since back in the 80s, it's been moving away from the sun, and that's why there was this big ferment in NASA for years and years and years to get a probe out there while it still had an atmosphere, while whatever atmosphere and global dynamics and weather that it had was still ongoing, because if you get the probe there too late, it takes, you know, like 10, 12 years to get there. If you arrive when the whole atmosphere is frozen out and has fallen on the ground as snow, then you basically have a dead, you know, ball of rock with some snow on top, and that's not very interesting. So the JPL guys that were trying to get behind the Pluto mission were really pushing the Congress and the president to get a mission funded to get out to Pluto while it's still warm enough that there'd be something interesting to observe when they got there. Well, something strange happened on the way to Pluto. As it's getting further from the sun and should be getting colder and colder and the atmosphere getting thinner and thinner and activity going lower and lower, in fact, it's exactly the opposite, Art.
Getting warmer.
It's getting warmer. There's more atmosphere. It's fluffier. There's clouds. There's weather. There's changes in light. There's all kind of, and by the time, you know, the New Horizon mission gets there in a few years, at the end of this decade, it'll be an amazing place. The only problem being, where is the energy coming from? Because a quick calculation shows you that if it was coming from the sun, which is the latest, model in vogue, latest fad, that, you know, all these planetary changes we talked about 3 years ago are basically the sun is doing it. If the sun was making Pluto warmer, then you and I would not be having this conversation, because the life on Earth would be extinct. The sun would have to be so warm to warm Pluto up to the extent that it is.
So we'd be boiling.
Pluto is my canary in the mine for the hyperdimensional model, that there's something bigger going on than SUVs. Yes, we on Earth have done very dumb and stupid things and continue to do them, and we should do a lot of the things to get not really, you know, cheaper SUVs and more efficient fossil fuel, you know, mechanisms. We need a radically different energy source. We need to stop emitting carbon dioxide and other, you know, fossil fuel emissions, period. But even that won't solve the problem, because the background physics is changing. So I'm not against the global warming people, the ones that say it's us that are the problem. Mm. We're just not the whole problem. We're, in fact, probably a small part of the problem. I listened carefully to your climatologist the other night. She made some good points. But what she's not taking into account is that this is going on all over the solar system, and it's all in consonance with our little canaries in the mine, to mix our metaphors here again, the bees. The bees are telling us there's something radically going on that's not man-made.
Richard, if it is the alignment, the spin, the wobble,
It's all of
the alignment of the planets, whatever, then it seems to me that's very far out of our control. And so if we take the leap and we assume that you're correct, and this is what's going wrong with the bees, then Robert in Anaheim asks, will you please lay down, if you believe all this to be true, what you think the solution to the bee problem is?
The solution is so simple for the bees.
Okay.
The solution is to simply go back to natural organic hives. You can make organic hives on a corporate scale, but you got to let the bees define your geometry. The organic hives, they don't care if they're moved. They don't care if they're mites. They are incredibly, I mean,
Wait, Richard, wait.
Yes?
If that's true, then again, you have not defined, you've said these hive changes have been here for a couple of hundred years. So again, you haven't proven what has changed in this last year versus the last couple of hundred years.
Let me try to do an analogy, okay?
Sure.
I'm trying to describe a spiral staircase without waving my arms, which on radio is hard.
Right.
So what I want everybody to do is I want them to close their eyes. Listening to radio, closing your eyes is good. I want you to imagine a large, flat pond, a still evening just after sunset where you have twilight. There isn't a breath of wind, and the pond is absolutely glassy smooth, okay?
Okay.
And you've got some balls out there. Think of them as tennis balls or ping pong balls or whatever, and they're scattered around, okay? And somehow you've got little motors in them, and you start them rotating. And what will happen is you will have waves spreading out from each of these little spinning balls.
Yes.
And the waves will interact with each other.
Yes.
Now, how will they interact? They will create ripples. The ripples will have a wavelength, in other words, between crest to crest to crest.
Sure.
And they will have an amplitude.
Sure.
If I have another, let us make a detector for this. Let's say we've got a little special ball which has a light in it, okay? And we toss it out on the pond, and the sun is setting, and it's getting dark, and now we can't see the pond or the ripples, so we don't know what's going on. Mm-hmm. All we see is one little ball with the light in it, and what do we observe? We know, because we saw it in daylight, that we've got all these ripples going back and forth, interference patterns. The amplitude's getting bigger, smaller, the wavelength changing. But all we see of our little lighted ball is it's going up and down, up and down.
Mm-hmm.
And it changes going up and down erratically. Sometimes it sits almost still. Other times it's violently jerking up and down, a little bit from side to side. And what we have to do is mathematically piece together the invisible model of the waves causing the motion of our lighted detector in the dark. That's what we're dealing with in torsion field physics. We have to make detectors that respond to these invisible waves. Life itself, it turns out, is fundamentally based on torsion field interactions. That's why insects have those antennae. They are tuned torsion wave detectors in this model. And the bees have been building comfortably for millions of years natural size honeycomb that responds to the changes in the background physics. When the artificial guys came in and forced them all to live in one size honeycomb, that was fine for the last couple hundred years, Art, when there was no real change going on in the physics. But as we opened the show, you wrote the book, you called it The Quickening. When the background changes, when the environment is no longer the way it used to be, you either adapt or die. And the natural bees are living in a variety of size honeycombs, and they simply move from one part of their hive to another, and they're perfectly happy. The artificial guys, the corporate ones that are forced to live in the big honeycomb with the fixed rigid cell size that's too big for the frequency passing through the hive, it is actually making them sick and driving them away, and they can't find their way home, and millions are disappearing every day.
Okay, when I wrote the book, I did it, as I told you earlier in the program, based mostly on intuition and observation, Richard, that events were cascading and were speeding up. Now, I did not prove that there was some great change going on in the universe, in our solar system, with the rotating bodies, the planets beginning to create a different frequency. I suppose it amounts to the same thing, but I didn't prove anything scientifically, and I'm not altogether sure that you have either. What you've got to prove here is the actual change in frequency that's resonating in these hives.
The way we will do that is with measurements. As I said, I need to find myself a local bee guy, you know, a commercial guy and an organic guy, and I need to sit them down and I need to say, can I measure the frequencies as this physics is changing and just see what we see? I know I've got a measurable system that is measuring this physics, and in terms of celestial alignment stuff, it's astonishing. It is so incredibly in keeping with the predictions of what we thought we could see, over and above what Marie Salleh saw back in 1954. You know, he was the Nobel laureate in economics, mm-hmm. who actually wanted to be an astronomer and did all these astronomy and physics measurements of pendulum motions and all that.
Yes.
And during the eclipse in Paris in 1954, he discovered that during a solar eclipse, when the moon comes between the Earth and the sun, he got a sudden shift in the pendulum motion that was completely unpredicted, mm-hmm. completely contrary to anything Newton or Einstein or anybody else has written, that in fact is torsion. It's got to be torsion. It's the only thing that's left. So if you relate his work to Kozyrev's work and Shipoff's work and all the other guys that have written these 10,000-plus papers, there's a huge body of peer-reviewed mainstream science that's been kept from the Western physicist by design, basically, because the torsion field, if you really get into it, aren't, torsion field physics gives us anti-gravity, it gives us space propulsion, it gives us free energy, it gives us the keys to the kingdom. And there's a few folks here that wouldn't want the society to have all that, so they really don't want us talking about much of this. And it's useful tonight that we're able to have this discussion and people can begin their own observations in their garages.
All right, but in the meantime, to solve the bee problem, it's your contention they would merely have to change the construction of the hives and go back to the way it was.
Exactly. Now, you can scale that up to industrial size. You can take hives.
Right.
You can cart them around.
Sure.
Because the natural hives are happy. They're pest-free. But now we're getting into something that is almost like a religion, aren't? Because you have these two groups intensely polarized, and I found out how polarized when I started going through the web articles and the web papers and the blogs between the two groups. There was a guy who tried to mediate between them, and both groups turned on him like he was the enemy, because he was saying you don't have to be the strict purist in terms of organics. You can actually, you know, you don't have to suffer huge diebacks when you go from the large comb back to the small comb, because the hives lose something like 70 to 80% of their population when you do that, you know, which for a commercial beekeeper would be catastrophic.
Sure.
This guy was able to make the transition by going to the multiple sizes with very minimal losses, 5%, 6%, something like that. So that's usually what beekeepers sustain during a winter-summer season. One of the things that was so interesting and how this relates to Kozyrev is Kozyrev found in his torsion experiments that at certain times of the year, as we orbit the sun on this spinning planet, mm-hmm. his experiments worked fine. Other times of the year, he couldn't make them work at all. Now, what does that mean?
Science really hates that.
Huh?
Science really hates
that. Absolutely. That's what killed cold fusion. That unless you have the conditions right, just right, and the conditions are changing. I mean, cold fusion, by the way, is a torsion field phenomenon. You probably already suspected that, okay? Anyway, Kozyrev found that during the fall and winter, the experiments worked wonderfully. Mm-hmm. During the summer, they worked not at all. Well, this bee guy, this organic beekeeper who'd done these 15 years of experiments with different hive sizes and different cell sizes, found that in a natural honeycomb, the bees make different size comb, and they inhabit them at different times of the year, and they grow and they shrink in terms of the future generations, dependent on the seasons. A natural hive has a natural growth and diminution of bee size based on the size honeycomb they prefer to live in at that particular month. Mm. And this is replicable year after year after year. And he's trying to tell both of these sides, the commercial guys and the organic guys, wait a minute, you both have a piece of the puzzle, and they're not talking to each other, and they basically ostracized him and drove him out of the business. So our hardest problem is not to solve the problem. It's going to get these guys to sit down with each other and talk to each other and basically have a conversation where, for the benefit of everybody, they drop their preconceptions, they look at the data, and they start doing something different. Remember the old definition of insanity.
Well, there's nothing like bankruptcy to get you talking.
Hopefully they'll talk before they get to bankruptcy.
Well, they've got to be close. If the numbers we're hearing about are anywhere near correct, Richard, then
I think they're on the low side, Art. I think we're getting filtered corporate media, and people don't want everybody to know how bad it really is. That's why you're getting all these theories that come out.
It's in Europe as well. It's not just here.
Now, get this. It's only in the Northern Hemisphere. Did you know that?
I think I did. I know that Australia has no such problem.
Nope, and South America, and, you know, now why is that? Because it turns out from Kozyrev's work that the torsion field physics based on a spinning Earth is asymmetric. The Northern Hemisphere is different in the rotating frame than the Southern Hemisphere.
Okay.
And, I mean, there's no way I can, in a few minutes on the radio, describe the stunning litany of experiments reinforce this whole idea. My job tonight is to get people curious enough, excited enough, you know, uncertain enough to go and want to research further. Go to the web. Don't even go to Enterprise. Go look up, you know, Google yourself. Start organic bees, cell size honeycomb, Nicholas Kozyrev, torsion field physics. It's all there. We have this stunning tool called the World Wide Web. Use it, people. Do your own homework. It'll take you just a few days to discover some amazing things. And the bottom line is you're going to come out exactly where I've come out, in that there's some background environmental thing which suddenly changed, and it has to do with the frequency matching into the size of the comb, and that's why the commercial bees are abandoning their homes.
Now, Richard, other than the bees, what else do you think it's affecting?
Well, I think it's affecting everything. You know, remember, the bees are a frequency detector. The weather is an amplitude detector. Mm-hmm. You talked with Evelyn before about energy?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, why do you think this coming solar cycle, 24, is going to be a mind-boggler? It's because the amplitude of energy coming into the solar system, gating in from hyperspace, which is what is causing the ripples on the pond, that's where the energy is coming from, is opening wider and wider, and the amplitude of energy is getting higher and higher, and the frequency is going up. That's where your quickening comes in. And this affects, you know, a whole cascade of systems, not just weather. It affects sun, solar activity. It affects consciousness. Have you been noticing unusual sociological things lately in you know, when you watch television, when you watch, you know,
yes.
Basic events?
Yes, it's part of what I call the quickening.
Yeah.
Sure.
Have you noticed, for instance, that people seem to be more and more unable to lie? It's kind of like that Jim Carrey movie. They will blurt out. Look at the Don Imus thing. All right? Look at what happened with Al Sharpton a few days ago.
Oh, yes.
Look at, I mean, it's like, it, you know, the politic thing to do when you're a public person is to look at Baldwin with his daughter.
All right.
I'm seeing a change in social behavior across the board where we're basically more impulsive, and there are more impulsive explosions of emotion.
Richard, if the ability to lie leaves us, then truly we are near the end of the world. Hold it right there. We'll come back and open the phone lines. This should be interesting. Richard C. Oakland is my guest. I'm Art Bell.